presentation, followed by a joint Q&A. So please hold all your questions till the very end of the session. Gentlemen, the stage is yours. Thank you.
Sure it works that way?
Okay, cool.
All right. Greetings all. My name is Stephen Harney. I am the territory manager for AgriCoatings and the southeast area, also the territory expansion states. I've been in the industry for over a decade. It's been a love that I've really kind of came in to have the same kind of appreciation that I cherish my love for kids, fitness, wellness, golf, and fishing. I'd like to first off start by thanking the Mulch and Soil Council for giving us the opportunity to speak today. I'd also like to thank Colorbiotics and AmeriMulch for participating in the presentation with us. Thank you. AgriCoatings is a division of American Colors Incorporated. We recently celebrated our 50th anniversary in July. We are a global company with 5 plants in Ohio, Texas, Tennessee, China, and Italy. While you may know us for our work in the mulch industry, our impacts, it extends far beyond. American Colors started in the gel coat business and has since grown to serve a vast range of industries. Within the automotive sector, we supply interior materials for multiple car manufacturers like BMW and Mercedes. Notably, we have materials that were just showcased on the Mario Andretti's winning car at the Indy 500. We're also prevalent in the construction and home goods sector, as our formulations are often found inside the paints that you may find at Lowe's and Home Depot. Extending to countertops and cultured marbled sinks like those found in some of the major hotels in Las Vegas. Our recreation and design products can be found on Sea Ray yachts, Olympic sailboats, even the iconic Swan and Dolphin here on top of the Disney hotels in Orlando. We have specialty materials like laser applied coatings for bottles, formulations for Crayola sand, large footprint also in the cosmetic industry. While our name isn't on the finished product, our materials are a key component in a vast number of consumer and industrial goods. So now that everyone's just a little familiar with who we are, I'd like to dive into the history of mulch. But first, I have a question that I always find interesting because everybody has their own story inside our industry. I've met so many people, and I always find a person who tells me that they were the first person to create colored mulch. So I would like to know if anybody has, raise your hand if you think or you know someone who has made that stake. Anybody? Anybody? No? No one? Okay. Well, it's a good topic. Oh, yeah?
Grande.
Yep. We were in the National Mulch Business, and a gentleman came to see me and had this idea about colored mulch. And I said, "Get me out of here."
Look at us today.
I said, "This is a stupid idea." And here we are.
See, that's what I'm talking about.
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
That's what I'm talking about. It's fun just to hear people's stories, right? I think that everybody has their journey, everybody has their venture, and I equally appreciate everybody's story. So thank you. Appreciate it. Colored mulch, made from wood and dyed with water-based solutions, first appeared at a landscaping show in the 1980s. And became a viable product by the early 1990s. Initially sold only in bulk high-end nurseries, its popularity exploded after the turn of the millennium. The mulch industry shift to a manufactured product was driven by a changing in the lumber system, recycling efforts, and a growing demand for aesthetic landscaping materials. A few of the reasons why popularity of colored mulch arose were due to curb appeal, waste utilization, longer lasting color, making it a lower maintenance product than organic mulch. As mulch evolved, historically, it was always a natural product like leaves or bark used to conserve moisture and suppress weeds. But in the mid-20th century, bark became a more popular byproduct through the lumber industry. However, in the 1990s, a decline in the lumber industry and a ban on yard waste in landfills created a new source for mulch. Recycled wood from pallets, construction debris, ground-up stumps, they just became the new norm. However, you know, the recycled wood, it had an inconsistent color, leading manufacturers to add dyes to create a uniform, visually appealing product. As the shade and color trends grew, the colored mulch industry became dominated by, of course, three main colors. Although there's lots of requests for lots of different colors, it's pretty much owned by three. We all know them, red, black, and brown. Red, one of the first popular dyed mulches, offered a vibrant high contrast that was especially popular in the 1990s. While creating a beautiful commercial appeal, its main drawback is an inconsistent shade due to the sensitivity to differentiating raw materials. As landscaping shifted more into a natural look, brown mulch gained the popularity. It really mimics the appearance of natural aged wood and became most popular by about 2017 due to its versatility and multiple color shades available. Black, in the recent years, has become a top choice for those seeking a more modern, dramatic aesthetic look. And it's added benefit for warming the soil due to its naturally occurring higher heat absorption. With an increase towards brown after the turn of the century, the last decade has shown that these three colors have consistently maintained the following percentages at a national level. Black's at about 44, brown we've got at about 41%, and red is somewhere around 15. From a regional standpoint, that looks a little bit different, obviously. We've got the Northeast at about 69% for black, 22% for brown, and red at about 11. We've got the Midwest at 41%, brown's at 52, and the red's at 7. In the South, much different numbers there. Lots of red down here. We've got black at 40%, brown at about 39, so they're pretty much the same. Red, 21%. I know a lot of people would really like to get rid of red, but, you know, it's still hanging on. With the process of coloring mulch changing over the years, advancements in colorizing technology have led to a fundamental shift in the industry's approach to cost, thus causing an overall shift in business philosophy. While producers once focused on the most economic price per pound of colorant, now they really prioritize cost per cubic yard. This new philosophy is built around higher quality, more efficient colorants that require less poundage per cubic yard to achieve the superior result. Advancements in the colorant industry continue to expand, and designing a financially lean product that is catered to a specific overhead has really never been easier. As the three main colors continue to stay the same, economically driven product lines inside those – I have a bug, sorry. As the three main colors continue to stay the same, economically driven products inside those colors are expanding at great lengths. Agri-coatings, as an example, manufactures four different lines, completely different lines. We have a high-performance line that has the highest quality pigments attainable inside the colorant industry. The HP line provides unmatched vibrancy while yielding the colorant strength that guarantees a weather-durable finish. Primarily popular inside the bagging industry due to its low cost per cubic yard. We have the Legacy line, known for its diverse color spectrum and its unique binding characteristics. It's usually tint-specific, though. It's while being very sensitive to quality. another notch down, the Advantage line is an economic option. Delivers the quality, varying color shades. Most popular within the bulk operations that are really scaling up in size while trying to reduce cost at the same time. And a classic line, which more often than not will lead to like a really aggressive pricing structure, but it has shade limitations, right? So it's ideal for low-cost solutions while still offering consistent coverage and durability. While colorants have evolved to meet standards, the equipment evolution has been equally impressive. The history of mulch coloring equipment over the last 25 years has been defined by innovation aimed at adding value to wood waste. In the late 1990s, the pioneering of innovation began. A major breakthrough in 1997, with the introduction of the very first grind and color system, which integrated coloring process directly into the grinder. This significantly reduced labor and handling costs. Colorant companies like Colorotics and Amerimulch, they pioneered equipment like the Sahara and the Colortron machines, thus solidifying the role of the colorant companies inside the equipment market. From the 2000s to the present day, we've seen continuous advancements from every angle. The industry has since doubled down on the push for greater coloring efficiency as well as operational specialization. Companies now offer standalone and integrated systems along with advanced features like remote monitoring to track colorant usage and production metrics. As coloring machines became more available, entering the coloring market created operational complexities along with being financially cumbersome. To counteract the potential financial burdens, companies then started building functional coloring systems through retrofitting existing equipments like grinders, augers, trommels, thus providing mobility for really a low startup. This method has historically been a practical solution and is still utilized today. While modifying existing equipment has been proven to be successful, dedicated coloring machines have long been the standard. Offering a repeatable and efficient process, these machines are specifically designed for coloring mulch. The common two standalone colorizers do have different operational methods, though. One, the tumbling method, right, where material is fed into a rotating incline drum. Gravity and centrifugal force tumble the mulch while it is simultaneously sprayed with colorant and water. While the maintenance cost appears to be minimal, margins of error potentially exist due to raw material feed rates and inaccurate angles coming off and at the peak of where the mulch comes out. Paddling and auger methods use push. A drive push material through the chamber, this method is highly effective for separating stringy materials, ensuring a more even colorant coverage. However, maintenance overhead, it's a complex issue. You know, the high torque and the driving action can really be a little cumbersome to kind of work around from a financial standpoint. Both types of colorizers use the weight per gallon as a metric to control colorant pounds per yard, though. While weight per gallon is a common metric used by mulch producers to control colorant pounds per yard and calculate cost effectiveness, relying on that alone to gauge the colorant's quality, it can be misleading. In the past, many producers mistakenly used a high weight per gallon as a primary indicator for a colorant's quality. However, a high weight per gallon does not automatically translate to a superior performance or expected results. The true measure of a colorant's effectiveness lies in its color strength. Color strength is the key indicator for a colorant's quality, and more importantly, its weatherability in the field. Colorant strength is determined by two major factors. One, the quality of the pigments and additives used. Two, how effectively the pigment is dispersed or mixed within the colorant. The industry has moved simply beyond focusing on cost per pound and really to a more refined approach by prioritizing color strength and the efficiency per cubic yard. Ultimately, focusing on color strength does provide a much clearer picture of how well a colorant will perform and the overall sustainability of its vibrancy. In closing, from the humble beginnings as a byproduct in the lumber industry, colored mulch has evolved into a key aesthetic amongst the landscaping market, driven by a customer and the advancements inside technology. This industry is the common ground for all of us here. And we take great pride in being a key component of this evolution. As a developer of quality colorants and equipment solutions, along with companies like Colorbiotics and AmeriMulch and our new partners from NextGen, we will continue to shape the future of mulch, offering solutions that not only enhance landscapes, but also optimize production for our customers. Notably, speaking of enhancements, as of today, I'm pleased to announce that we have a patent-pending AI solution that visually qualifies the quality of your end product. This AI solution dynamically controls all variables in real time with main features that manage color, will validate your size, and test your volume metrics. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Stephen. Again, my name is Nick Lincoln, the sales manager for Colorbiotics. I had the opportunity to start with a company by the name of Becker Underwood, which some of you might still remember, clear back in 2007, and started as an intern and have had various, you know, opportunities over the years. But I would say one of the neatest things is, you know, over time, I've probably been to mulch yards in around 24, 25 countries. So that's provided some nice, just, you know, perspective of things. I apologize that Brian and I are the only things that's left between everybody here and the bar. So we'll try to keep it moving along a little bit.
Play off baseball, so we're not going to take too much of your time.
But you know, a couple months ago, we had some calls with Tom and Shelley to try to, you know, kind of break up, you know, what is there to talk about with colored mulch for an hour here. So, bear with me. We're going to take a couple field trips and address a couple topics that directly affect the coloring of mulch, but not quite as much on the actual, you know, colorant itself. So can anybody guess in the last year what has been the number one question that we always get about colorants? It's been in the news everywhere. Tariffs. So, you know, you hear about the tariffs and everything that's going on with reciprocal tariffs, with what's going on with this country, back and forth. And the question is, what is that going to do to my pigment prices next year? We have customers to sell mulch to. We have Depot that's grinding down our throat. So just a little bit of a background here, and then we'll get into some of the nuts and bolts. But synthetic iron oxide, there is no synthetic iron oxide made in the United States. There's various other forms of oxide you can get in the United States, but there is no production here imported. It comes from other countries around the world. Why? Majority of the carbon that makes black and is also blended with brown is, in fact, you know, made a lot of it domestically here in the United States. So, tariffs. You know, winding the clock back, and I'm going to use the example of China because it's been the biggest in the news, and China is one of the leading manufacturers of what I would call grade A oxide that's made for red and blended in brown, obviously. But all iron oxide that comes in has a starting rate of 3.7%. If you look backwards to Trump's first term, he put a 25% tariff on oxide and a variety of other products that came in from China. So even through, you know, Biden's term, all of those tariffs have stayed in place, and that happened kind of just before COVID, which also had some indirect effects on that. Since Trump has taken You know, the presidency back, I think it was in the first couple weeks when he was there, he added an additional 10% tariff on top of the 25%. And within a month after that, he tacked on another 10%. And all of that is based upon China needs to do a better job of controlling the fentanyl drug problem that comes into the United States. So the good news and the bad news is, you know, you hear in the news all of these reciprocal tariffs that Trump has with China that go up to, you hear crazy numbers like 100%, 120%. The nice thing is, with this executive order, it's called the Annex II list. And I don't know how many people are familiar with that. There's a huge wide variety of goods on this list. But what that means is the tariffs are set on that list. And all of these reciprocal tariffs you hear about in the news, oxides and a variety of the other inputs that come from China are exempt. So that's something that there is a little bit of stability there. And if you hear that he gets back into a big war with China or other countries, thankfully oxide and some of the things on this, carbon black, if it comes from China, is also exempt to that. So has there been some impacts? Yes. But is it going to get as crazy as what you see in the news? Probably not. So just wanted to use a basic example. Let's say you're buying some oxide from China and it's $1 a pound. You throw on some of the different, you know, tariffs on top of that, and what used to cost $1 per pound is now 48.7% more expensive since 2018. So that's just one thing we get a lot of questions on. Now, thankfully, it has been fairly stable here, and I think we should hopefully see some stability. It takes time to get stuff coming from China, but hopefully now we're in a little bit of a stable zone moving into this fall and into next year. So that was a little side trip on tariffs. The next thing, a couple things I want to talk about here. You know, we heard a lot about mold in the last presentation, and I want to talk about three different things that affect the coloring of mulch outside of the colorant of itself, and that is the species of the wood, the grind size, and the moisture content. All three of those things play a huge role in how you color mulch. So this picture, this is 3 pounds of colorant on, what is that, 7 or 8 different types of wood source. It's a straight red colorant, and you can see the impact that it has on the finished quality. It doesn't matter whether it's black. If you put black colorant on fresh sawmill, lumber, or pallet wood, it's going to look different than if you age hardwood over the winter and then put black colorant on that. So the reason I bring that up is I know everybody in this room is constantly dealing with, you know, Matt and them. They talked about different wood sources and where to find wood and Grant. But the thing here, one of the best things you can do is just blend. Try to blend it together so you're not using one product in the fall, one product later in the spring, and all of a sudden during the middle of the spring you start getting into fresher wood and it looks different and you get complaints. So just something to be aware of that. You know, red, for example, you cannot take a dark aged hardwood. I don't care if you put 10 pounds of the most concentrated red on the planet, you're never going to get it to look as good as a bright red on a light pallet or a pine or some kind of that material. So wood species does play a part. And also getting, if you can get a little bit of age on the material, you know, she talked about some of the mold and the organic content. You can actually track it in your mulch. So we've done some studies. So if you first grind material, the organic activity in that material spikes up hugely. The wood goes into shock, and it wants to expel some of the tannins and lignins, and the organic activity goes crazy for about the first month is the tipping point. And then after that starts to calm down, A, the mulch is, you know, a lot less likely to cause mold, and B, it wants to accept colorant back into the mulch much better if you let it calm down after that first grind. Now, if you primary grind it and you let it sit for a while, you can secondary grind it or screen it or whatever you want and run it right through a coloring machine and it'll behave just fine. It's just getting some age on that primary grind on the wood species really helps. Next topic I wanted to talk about is just some of the trends going on with mulch fines or the size of the material. Matt mentioned it, but the bag industry and the bulk industry have hugely different priorities and hugely different requirements in grind size. You go buy a bag of mulch from the box store, a lot bigger, chunkier material. A lot of the more bulk stuff is a smaller material. So the first thing I wanted to you know, when we look at a Newsom studies, what we consider a fine is anything under a quarter inch screen. So you take a bucket, you screen it. And what we do is we've looked at some of the numbers across the country. And these are some averages on fines. And honestly, if you took and you look at these numbers, so the Northeast leads the nation. I swear you people in the Northeast, it is getting pretty close to coloring dirt. And sometimes I can't tell if you're trying to color compost, if you're trying to color mulch, but that is what the people up there love. They love it fine, kind of like some areas in Texas. They love it jet black, and it is... So with these numbers being said, in the Northeast, if you did a test, 54% of the material in a yard of mulch is less than it'll go through a quarter inch screen, which is, if you took the bag people out of this, it would probably be much, much higher than that even. But what I want to talk about briefly is just how does that impact your coloring operation? What is that having fines in, not having fines in mean? Because on one hand, you have the consumers driving that. On the other hand, there's costs and other things associated when you color mulch, because if you think about it, when you run something through a coloring machine, what soaks up all the color? The fines. When you put mulch down in a landscape bedding, where do the fines go? To the bottom. So when you have a bunch of fines in the material, and you have big pieces and little pieces, and the fines with all the color go to the bottom, you have the big pieces on top that have the least amount of color on top, and so it's a little bit misrepresented. The best thing you can do when you're making mulch is get your particle sizes, whether you want it to be an inch, 2 inches. The closer in size all those pieces are, the better your mulch is going to look across the board. So here's just something we looked at. You know, if you look at surface area and you take something that is mostly 2 inches or bigger and you look at something that's a half an inch or smaller, that puts roughly 6x the surface area of mulch that you have to color. So we're taking a couple pop cans of color and a bunch of water and trying to get it to spread. And think about what it takes to color 4, 5, 6x the surface area as you start bringing, you know, fines into the mix. So it's all obviously dictated on what your consumers and what they want, but there are costs and time and screening or whatever that may be associated with that. So with that being said, we came up with a little bit of a study, and the goal of this study was to make the same looking mulch, and what does it take to make the exact same looking mulch as your fines content go up. So we said, hey, let's take a baseline of something with 10% fines in it. Let's say it's going to a box store, and let's just set the starting color rate at 1.5 pounds per yard and use the minimal amount of water. And then we actually took and extrapolated that out, was what would that do to the weight of your mulch? So as you start going up, you can see, okay, you go to 30%, a little bit increase in color, you go to 50% a little bit, but as you start getting up 70, 80, 90% fines, your amount of color and water increase. So you have your fines that are increasing the weight of your mulch, but as you can see on the curve for the color rate, the line starts to get steeper. So if you want all the mulch to look the same, as your fines go up, your color rate has to go up also. And that's part of the reason that with the bulk market being driven by finer material, people are having to put more colorant on than what you say, you know, you see potentially at a box store. So same thing goes with water. You can see as the fines, the water rate also goes up. So what does that mean as far as the impact of water and fines? I mean, most people you talk to will say in a bag of mulch, or bulk mulch works too, 18 to 20% of the cost of a bag of mulch nationally is freight. The cost that it takes to ship. So screening out the fines, using the least amount of water, you get your weight down and, you know, you start saving costs here and there. Well, if you look at the combination of fines and the additional water needed to cover those fines, something with 10% fines and the amount of water, you know, weighs, let's call it just shy of 400 pounds per cubic yard. And as you get up to 90% fines, it jumps up to almost 480 pounds per cubic yard. And that costs you, what is my math bad, but let's call it around 17 cubic yards per truck is the difference in freight between those two. So as you pull those triggers, as you screen out a little bit of fines here, 10% fines, 20% fines, will have a big, along with water, will have a big impact on how much you can ship on a truck. I know not everybody is blessed to be in Michigan, where you basically have no rules on how much you can put on the road with 18-inch thick concrete or whatever the heck they use in Michigan. So it's important. You know, it affects the amount of your color usage, you know, when you're going through it that way. And then to end here, just wanted to talk about what's in your tote. You know, any of us three sitting up here, there's a variety of different things in your tote. You know, you have water obviously needed, but you have dispersants and pH modifiers. And the whole goal of that is if you put, take a look at, orange juice that's got a whole bunch of pulp in it. What happens to that pulp over time? It wants to settle to the bottom of your orange juice. You got to shake up the orange juice when you get into the fridge. Same thing with colorants. If you drop some rocks into a glass of water, where would those rocks go? They'd want to go to the bottom. If you drop rocks into a milkshake, would they go to the bottom as fast? Not quite. So a lot of times we will purposely thicken up colorants a little bit to keep all of these particles in suspension because it helps over time. So a certain amount of thickness is good. Too much thickness can lead to pumping issues or stability issues or turning to a paste or some of that kind of stuff. And then there's defoamers, resin, you know, to help some of the colorant adhere to the mulch, and then obviously the pigments. And, you know, majority of us do use some small form of a biocide, but that biocide is strictly to keep mold and different things from growing in the liquid tote of color, not necessarily to have any sort of an impact on the finished mulch. There's just not enough of it in there to really, you know, have an issue. You know, a few best practices. You can look at the front of any one of our totes, and just a few things to always remember. Stability, you know, most of these coatings, no different than paint for your house, you're not going to see many shelf lives much longer than a year. So keep that in mind as you're storing stuff over the winter. Keep black coloring out of direct sunlight. It can cause it to crust up a little bit on the top. You know, mix the totes for about 30 minutes. And I would say the number one thing, and that's what the pictures are here, is we do freeze-thaw cycles, is do not let the colorants freeze. When they freeze, it shocks them. I mean, has anybody ever tried to freeze a can of house paint for your house and then try to mix it up and use it? Similar thing here. It has a big impact if you let it freeze. And then lastly, you know, mulch is weird when it comes to weatherability. You know, most of the claims and things, you know, we want mulch to last for a season. Sell more mulch the next year, but mulch is interesting. When you put hardwood or anything into a giant pile, what happens to it? It darkens up a lot. You take that same mulch, and on this slide here, the 500 hours, these are QSUN tests, 1,000 hours. They simulate a year of Florida sunshine. But you take that same mulch that darkened up over the winter, you don't put any pigment or anything on it. You put it in a landscape setting, and in the course of 6-8 months, it'll bleach completely white. So when we're painting mulch, we're not exactly painting mulch. We're basically tinting the mulch to help prevent the mulch from bleaching white. We're trying to hide that so that it maintains its look, you know, for majority of the season. So just a few things, kind of auxiliary topics, you know, around coloring mulch that I thought maybe, you know, would be helpful as you start pre-packing this fall or getting ready to color in the spring. So thank you.
I'm going to try not to use the microphone. You guys know me. I'm a pretty loud guy. Hopefully, can everybody hear me? Recorder. It's being recorded. Not without my consent.
I'm going to stand up and walk around because I'm more comfortable doing this. See how we're going here. Topics I'm going to touch on today. The size of the color enriched mulch marketplace. What percentage is that is packaged versus bulk? Percentages, what we estimate the fiber sources by a percentage basis are serving our industry, and who buys our products and why do they do it? While you guys read a little Dilbert cartoon, I'll tell you our data collection process because it is not exact. While we have a great understanding of what our current customer base the amount of materials they're making and putting in the marketplace. We have a good understanding of folks who talk to us freely because we bring value. We have an understanding of what they do. But there's a segment of the marketplace that we're guessing on what they do. We drive by your yards. We kind of look. They got a big pile of raw material there. They got a big pile of colored there. Yeah, that guy uses about 3 or 4 truckloads of color in a year. So there is some guessing this stuff. Everybody's not opening up their books to us and telling us exactly how much product they're making. Part of it we know, some of it we're making assumptions. So keep that in mind as I share this with you. At the end, in the late 80s, early 90s, and Mr. Trinetti was correct, Color Mold started, in my view, at a pallet manufacturer in Akron, Ohio, by a gentleman named Greg Romney. He was paying somebody to take this off his property. At his church, there was a gentleman named Tom Kurtz and the Kurtz family who had a large landscape supply house. Greg went to those folks and they said, man, look at this red. Put some red on oxide on this pallet material. What do you think of that? They looked at him and told him he was crazy. Let me just put some in the bin, and if people don't buy it, I'll pick it up. Well, you know what? They bought it, and they're still buying it. And this whole great industry started right there. We estimated in 1995 that there were 711,000 cubic yards of color-enriched mold sold. By 2023, primarily at the beginning, guys, this product was sold in Midwestern and Northeast suburban population centers. Philadelphia, Baltimore, Cleveland, Chicago, Milwaukee. Wasn't sold in the country, wasn't sold in the inner city, primarily Midwestern suburban population centers. By 2003, the southern markets had opened up, became more popular in the south. By 2009, the western marketplace is open, and you could see the dramatic size of the amount of product being sold. By this time, it's becoming widely acceptable. It's taken over for cypress and for pine straw and for hardwood bark. Drive around your neighborhoods and look at the percentage of a color-enriched mulch product on the ground as compared to a natural product. You're going to see it grows every year. You can see the growth through the banister there. Between 2012 and 2025, it continues to grow. We've had some bumps in the road through housing crises. We saw some bumps up during COVID. While it grows every year, there has been some bumps. As we get to 2023, and again, guys, these numbers are our best estimation because we don't have open books to everywhere. 2023, we estimated over 60 million cubic yards of colored, enriched mulch sold in this country. Of that portion, we estimate 60% of it is bulk, 40% in package. That number varies by region to region. South Florida is much more package. Texas, a lot more bulk. Carolina's more bulk, so it changes region to region. Some regions is just flipped. Some regions it's 60% package and 40% bulk. This is our understanding of what the national number is. Excuse me. We separated these fiber sources into 3 buckets. We all know at the beginning it was all pallet fiber and it was all red. As the markets matured, demand grew, regulations on sawmills put residuals into our market, we divided it into 3 buckets. Pallet material, sawmill residuals including bark, land clearing material, mixed green waste, tree company chips. That's the way we look at it on a national scale. We all know there's more bark in the Northwest, more bark, more sawmill residuals in the West, more land clearing material in different, parts of the country. Now, who's your customer? No matter what we all do, no matter if it's sold through a big box store, whether it's sold through a landscaper's doing it, our whole great industry comes down to a homeowner making a purchasing decision. I call that homeowner Mrs. Jones. Now, Mrs. Jones doesn't look at mulch like we do.
We'll look at a 1,000-pound, 1,000-cubic-yard pile of mulch. We'll pick out that 1 4-inch piece. It's not as colored, and we kind of lose our minds on it. Mrs. Jones does not stand over her azaleas and look at that little piece of mulch. It's uncolored. She looks at mulch as she runs in her neighborhood, as she's walking her dogs, as she's sitting on her deck. So she has different performance expectations. Well, let me talk a little bit more about Mrs. Jones. Mrs. Jones, we know that some bulk producers have had success making a much finer product that they expect in the Northeast. By putting more color on it, they get a premium price for it, right? The bulk manufacturers, some of them have segregated a premium product that they get a premium price for. The packagers have tried this, haven't been as successful offering a premium priced, premium quality size and colored product in the packaged marketplace. They haven't had near the success as the bulk producers have. So in closing, I would say, your goal should be to understand what your marketplace wants. You don't want to overproduce or make an overperforming product than your customer base was, because you're leaving some money on the table. You don't want to make an underperforming product that they want, because you're going to lose sales. Understanding what your marketplace wants, because we know those products are very different. Understanding what they want and relying on the marketplace's feedback to you to understand what you should be making. So, now that we're done, and we have baseball and cocktails, let's get this over and ask any questions for the panel. Yes.
Have not seen a ton of that at this point, no. There were a lot of times through COVID, through earlier this year. A lot of what happened earlier this year was a lot of the containers around the world, when these tariffs went in place, a lot of the containers that shipped things were in the wrong places all over the world, because something gets tariffed in China, now people buy it from a different country, and the containers end up over there, and then they got to back over here. But regulatory-wise from China, we have not seemed to come across yet any restrictions getting them to release the product out. Now, it's the lead times have gotten a little bit longer for planning, but
my company uses magnets and uranium, major, and they are not released. So very interesting.
That would be a little concerning. Any other questions?
No more questions?
Thanks for coming. See you all in
awesome. Well, don't run out quite yet, please. I want to give me one more minute, please. I want to thank these gentlemen. Colorants are such a vital part of industry, our industry, obviously, and their expertise is muchly appreciated. So that's going to conclude our 2025 annual meeting. I hope you all have enjoyed the sessions as much as I have. It's truly been a fantastic experience serving as the chairperson for this year's event. Thank you to all MSC members for your attendance, and to speakers and sponsors for their outstanding contributions this week. A special thanks to Bob Bogossi, to his staff, and to the board of directors for their dedicated service to the board. And most of all, a huge thank you, she's not in here, unfortunately, a huge thank you to Shelley Williams for her hard work in coordinating this entire program. Shelley, if you can hear me, thank you so much for your support and guidance. I truly appreciate it. Now, let's celebrate together at President's Happy Hour, which is sponsored by Viably. Thanks, Viably. Thank you all again for being here. I am thirsty, so I'll see you soon. Cheers.
One last announcement. In about a week or so, we'll have all the presentations and the recordings of the presentations available on the website. We'll send out a notice to all people who attended the meeting. Thank you all for coming. Without you, I don't have anything to do all day. So if you need anything, call the office. We're happy to help. As Rudy said, it's all collaboration. You're all collaborating. Thank you. Thank you.